VCY America presents Crosstalk, a nationwide call-in program discussing issues that have an effect on our families, our communities, our churches, our nation, and our world. Crosstalk, an opportunity for you to voice your concerns for biblical principles. And now live by satellite and around the world on the internet at vcyamerica.org. Here is today's Crosstalk.
We do thank you for joining us today, and I trust you'll find our program quite interesting. April 15th is a day that will go down in notoriety. I mean, it was April 15th of 1865 that President Abraham Lincoln died. He was shot the night before at Ford's Theater. April 15th, 1912, it was the Titanic that sunk, having struck an iceberg the night before. April 15th, 1927 was the Great Mississippi Flood, where some 15 inches of rain fell in 18 hours, causing the Mississippi River to break out of its levee system, as well over 100 locations caused flooding in 10 states. And in 1954, April 15th became the deadline for filing income taxes. No doubt you've heard the familiar quote of Benjamin Franklin, who said this: "Our new Constitution is now established. Everything seems to promise it will be durable, but in this world, nothing is certain except death and taxes." We've all come to realize the impact that taxes have upon us, but are you aware of the history of the income tax, how it came about, what was the purpose, and is today's modern system of taxes a breach from what was originally intended? Well, joining us today, we welcome to Crosstalk William J. Federer. Bill is a nationally known speaker, historian, best-selling author, president of Amerisearch Incorporated. That's a publishing company dedicated to researching America's noble heritage. He's a speaker in the American Minute Daily Broadcast. He has authored numerous books. You've heard him on America's God and Country Encyclopedia Quotations, Socialism, the Real History from Plato to the Present, Who is the King in America, overview of some 6,000 years of history and why America is unique, and in a book on our topic today entitled The Interesting History of Income Tax. Bill, thank you so much for joining us.
Jim, great to be with you.
Bill, didn't the U.S. Constitution originally written prohibit a direct federal income tax on the citizens?
Right. So this is interesting that the way that the federal government paid for things back then was through taxes and tariffs. There was no income tax. So the U.S. Constitution, Article 1, Section 9 says, "No capitation or other direct tax shall be laid, unless in proportion to the census and so forth." But it specifically mentions that the federal government shall not have a direct tax on the citizens. And so again, people say, well, where'd the federal government get its money?
Yep.
Through tariff taxes on imports, things that came in from other countries, and from excise taxes on specific items like salt, tea, tobacco, et cetera. And so
this is something that caused people to buy from within the country then, rather than have to pay those excise or the tariffs, I should say.
Yeah, we're familiar with this with something called sin tax. So the idea was you tax cigarettes, you tax booze, make it more expensive. Why? So people won't buy them, won't use them. And so the idea is if you tax imports and make them more expensive, people will want to buy stuff from American factories at a cheaper price.
Hmm.
And so this helped the American factories to grow. And so, you know, you had the what's called the Industrial Revolution, or a guy named James Watt. England had coal. Ireland burned peat moss, this mucky mud they dried out, and it could, burn as bricks. But England had coal, and so they would dig in these coal mines, but the coal mines would fill up with water, and they would have to get buckets and try to get it out. Well, they worked on pumps, and so different guys tried stuff. Finally, a guy named James Watt came up with a contraption that would spin and use steam, and it would pump the water out, and it turned into the first steam engine.
Wow.
And so then it got adapted to being used with railroad, got adapted to be used with steamboats, but it got adapted to be used with factories. And
mm-hmm.
So England had these factories, and they made cloth, and they would get the raw cotton from America's South, and then they would make it into cloth, and then they would ship it back to America. But America wanted to get some factories going. But England was making stuff so cheap, we couldn't compete. And so these tariff taxes made stuff from England and France and Holland more expensive. Why? So people would buy stuff made in American factories.
Wow.
And so we began to see this boom economically in the North.
Take us up to Abraham Lincoln. And he had this emergency revenue tax during the Civil War. What was that about?
Yeah, well, so the tariff taxes, they helped the North but hurt the South. The South didn't have any factories, really. I mean, they were agricultural. They grew cotton. And so basically, when they placed the tariff taxes, people in the South now had to buy more expensive stuff from Europe or more expensive stuff from the northern factories. At one point, prior to the Civil War, the majority of the federal government was paid by tariff taxes collected at southern ports. So the South was basically carrying the weight of the federal government. A couple times, 1830s, the South threatened to secede, the North would threaten to send troops down there. And then finally, you had the Fort Sumter, where the North had a fort at the port of South Carolina and was going to stop all the ships and collect the tariffs, and the South didn't want them to do that. And so there was the firing upon Fort Sumter that began the Civil War, but tariffs were a part of that. And then you had Lincoln. Now, the federal government, originally the Constitution forbade the federal government. Matter of fact, originally, the states gave up zero independent power. And so there was this, what was called the Congress of the Confederation. It was called the Articles of the Confederation. The federal government got zero money unless the states voluntarily gave it. The states didn't give it. And so the federal government, so that's when they met again and they wrote the Constitution, which gave the federal government a little power, but again, most of it's left under the states. So we have this war between the states, and Lincoln has to finance the federal army somehow, and so he pushes through the revenue tax. It was a tax on individual people, on their incomes, and it was just an emergency effort, and he raised $750 million to pay for the Union forces during the Civil War. And there's a whole thing I wrote about the Confederate South. They were growing cotton. They problem was in the late 1850s, they had bumper cotton crops, and they sold it really cheap. And England bought lots and lots of it. And so when the Civil War starts, the South has terrible cotton crops. And so England's like, well, we bought enough last time, so we can skip a few years. And the South's like, realizing, well, tell you what, we'll make the make it more scarce. So they burnt millions of bales of cotton, thinking that it'll make the price go up, and it did. But in response, the British said, well, let's just buy cotton from India or China or and these other countries. And so the South shot itself in the foot.
Mm-hmm.
So instead of the English paying the higher price for the cotton, the English says, we'll just buy it from India. And so the South is really up a creek. Anyway.
So this revenue tax that President Lincoln had then during Civil War, that was eventually repealed, though, wasn't it?
It was repealed after the war in 1873. There was no more income tax really up until 1894. And you had socialism coming in. And you had some people saying, well, you know, let's Karl Marx, every man according to his ability, to every man according to his need. So they were going to come into America and say, let's take money from the rich people. And the rich people didn't want that to happen, obviously. They weren't rich because they were stupid. They were rich because they made good financial decisions. And so, but the first attempt to tax the rich, and the rich were the only ones that the income tax was addressed at, was in 1894. It went all the way to the Supreme Court, and guess what? The Supreme Court declared income tax unconstitutional in 1894. The case was Pollock versus Farmers Loan and Trust. The Supreme Court Justice Melvin Fuller said it was only to be allowed during an emergency of war, and the war is over. He says the original expectation was the power of direct taxation would be exercised only in extraordinary exigencies. And down to August 15th, 1894, this expectation was realized. So there was no income tax. Justice Stephen Field, in that Pollock versus Farmers Loan and Trust case, said the income tax under consideration is class legislation, which whenever a distinction is made in the burdens the law imposes or the benefit it confers on any citizen by reason of their birth, wealth, or religion, it is class legislation, leads to abuses. And he says it is the same in essential character as the English income statute of 1691,
wow,
which taxed Protestants at one rate, Catholics at double the rate, and Jews at a separate and third rate. So he's like, look, you can't tax people more because they're in one class or the other. So, again, Supreme Court in America, 1894, declared income tax unconstitutional.
Well, Bill, you mentioned the industrialists earlier, but they come back into play again.
Right. So there's the good side is that the tariff taxes made European goods more expensive, so people didn't buy them, so people bought stuff from American factories. And so the American factories were able to improve and improve and improve, and they began to produce steel really cheap so they could have railroads and then produce steamboats and then produce appliances for the farm. And basically, the standard of living was raised faster than any other period of time in world history. Women were freed from having to spend all day at a spindle making thread to sew clothes. They could buy a whole bolt of cloth really cheap. And the metal could make pipes. And so instead of going out to a well and putting the bucket on your shoulder and bringing it back home, they could get indoor plumbing. And so this was a great thing that it allowed this rise of the standard of living. But it also amassed an immense amount of wealth into the hands of these industrialists. And they derogatorily got called robber barons. And some of them were moral, and some of them were not moral. And the story is that you had John D. Rockefeller, and he had oil. And he would make an under-the-table deal with the railroads to ship his oil cheaper than his competitors.
Wow.
And then he would sell it cheaper and put his competitors out of business. Once they were out of business, he would raise the price of oil through the roof and recoup the money he lost, and then kick back to the railroads. And he did this over and over again until John D. Rockefeller, with his Standard Oil Company, became the richest man in the world.
My.
And so we began to see, like today, with the big tech wanting to control more and buying politicians, we began to see these industrialists begin to pay for the campaigns of politicians and pull their strings like puppets.
And folks, it hasn't changed. It doesn't seem it's changed from today. Bill Fitter is with us today. He is a nationally known speaker, historian, and best-selling author. We're talking about the history of the income tax. How did we get to where we are today? And talking about the industrialist, and folks, you're going to be introduced into President Roosevelt, who tried to limit their power. Back in a minute, you're listening to Crosstalk.
Back to Genesis with Dr. John Morris, scientist and creation seminar speaker with the Institute for Creation Research. Dr. Morris, during Creation Week, what kinds of fish were created?
Chris, the Bible says God created each of the animals after their kind. It says on day 5 of Creation Week that the fish were the first truly living creature that he created. This was the first use of the term living. On day 3, it created plants, but these are never in Scripture referred to as living in the sense that they had blood or the breath of life. Plants are biologically alive, of course, but not living in the sense of having consciousness. On day 5, however, the Bible says that the oceans were literally teeming with life. Each basic type of fish was created at that point. Since that time, a lot of varieties, say of the cod or the bass or the sharks, have arisen, but no new basic kinds. God created all things after their kind, back in Genesis.
For more information, visit our website at icr.org.
This is Crosstalk on VCY America. Bill Federer is our guest today. We're talking about the history of the income tax. Folks, pretty amazing to know that the Constitution originally written prohibited a direct federal income tax on the citizens of America. How did we get to this point? Well, Bill is explaining what's taken us to this point from the very beginnings of our nation here, and seeing how President Lincoln then passed this emergency revenue tax during the Civil War, but that was then repealed, and then there was a peacetime income tax attempted in 1894, but shot down by the Supreme Court at that time. He's talking about the rise of the industrial list and some of the matters going on that made the owner of Standard Oil Company very, very rich. And Bill, so let's pick up with those industrialists and then President Theodore Roosevelt, who tried to limit their power.
Sure. And by the way, all of this information is in a book. It's called The Interesting History of Income Tax. And
matter of fact, so, and we've got that available here through Crosstalk, our way of saying thank you for support of $18 or more. And I'll just mention it's available at vcyamerica.org, vcyamerica.org, or you may call our toll-free number 1-800-729-9829. So matter of fact, Bill, I know we're having to kind of skip to many different points here in the book, but I mean, the book as a whole is very informative to tie all these loose ends together.
Yeah, well, so picking up with Teddy Roosevelt, he took on the industrialists. This is like somebody today taking on big tech, right? So the big tech is canceling anybody that doesn't agree with them, that they can't control. Well, back then, you had these monopolists, and they were the J. Paul Gettys and the Astors and the Guggenheims and the John D. Rockefellers. So Teddy Roosevelt pushed through the inheritance tax. Who had an inheritance worth leaving? These rich guys. Hmm. So it was basically an end around to tax the rich. Then, because the Constitution prohibited a direct tax, then you had the next president is William Howard Taft. And he wants to tax these rich industrialists. And but since income tax is unconstitutional because 1894 decision, he places a 2% tax on corporate profits. Well, guess what? Only the extreme wealthy own corporate stocks. So these were end-arounds to go after the rich. Finally, World War One, and this emergency, and Woodrow Wilson, his attitude was, well, we had an emergency income tax on the people during the Civil War. This is World War One. Let's push through an emergency income tax that's going to tax everybody. But even in this one, it was just a 1% tax on the top 1% richest people in America. Mm. Right? It was pushed through. It's called the 16th Amendment. People say, well, you know, they really didn't pass the 16th Amendment properly. And if you look at the fine print, the states really didn't finish ratifying it. But at the time, everybody thought it's just going to go after those rich industrialists. It's never going to tax us.
Soak the rich.
And so the Rockefellers, Carnegies, Vanderbilts, Fisk, Flagler, Goulds, Harriman, Mellons, the Morgans, Schwabs, all of these robber barons, so to speak, they didn't like this. And so they realized that they had to cave at some point and go along with this income tax, but they immediately created tax-exempt charitable foundations. The Rockefeller Foundation, the Carnegie Foundation, this way they could still control all of their money. They just weren't taxed by it, and it was just in this foundation. That category was originally created for churches. Hmm. Why? Because the church did all the social work. The church took care of the poor, started orphanages, medical. The church started hospitals. The church did everything, and so it was basically these rich guys jumping into the church category and saying, you can't tax us. But the churches had soup kitchens, and they took care of the maimed soldiers from World War II and the unwed mothers and the shut-ins and the homeless. And then the churches provided a social service of producing a moral, virtuous population. You think, well, that's not that big of a deal. Wait a second. When you stop teaching morals and virtue, then you have theft and crime and broken families and child abuse and homelessness And then when that happens, you have property values go down. And then when that happens, you got vacant buildings that are set on fire, so you got to have more taxes to pay for the fire department and more taxes to pay for the police because of the increased crime. The tremendous domino effect of financial burdens on taxpayers because of this lack of morals being taught in the church, with the now the public school system. Matter of fact, you go through the public school system today, and they teach you there is no right or wrong. There is no God. You don't even know if you're a boy or a girl anymore. I mean, there's no borders, no guidelines, and you shove these kids out on the street, and there's no right or wrong. They have no conscience, fear of God. It's just whatever they can get away with. And as a result, we're seeing crime and violence and property values go down. So there is a value to churches producing morality in people. And the country understood this, and that's one of the reasons the churches had a tax exemption, and that's what these Rockefellers and Carnegies jumped into the church's category with their foundations.
Very interesting, because, I mean, we do see commands in Scripture for the church and its responsibility, but, Bill, I don't see commands in government for the caring of the poor or to, provide food or provide for education.
Right, so God gives commands to five main identifiable groups: individuals, families, business, church, and government. There are commands for individuals to take care of the poor. Families, mostly, it's relational. Husbands, love your wives. Children, submit to your parents. Business commands are mostly, do an honest day's work, don't hold back wages. There are commands for the church to take care of the poor, and historically the church has. And the church has started hospitals and orphanages and medical clinics and most of the schools and all of that. There's no command for the government to take care of the poor. There's no command for the government to be involved in healthcare, education. The command to the government is the shortest: protect the innocent, punish the guilty. What's happened is the government has usurped the church's role. When it does, the government begins to have a class of politicians that realizes that they get elected by promising the poor that they'll give them more. And they basically want the poor to stay poor so they can have the poor as voters so they can continually get their vote by promising to give them more.
Wow.
And so it's a bait and switch. Whereas if the church helps people, it wants the person to get out of their bad situation, become well off. Why? So they can give and help the next needy person that comes along.
Very interesting, Bill, because this is not what charity is supposed to be. I mean, when it's involuntary, it really is not charity any longer when you have the government doing it rather than the church.
Right. So the Bible's filled full of verses about private property. They go into the promised land, and the land is divided up and given as private property to each individual family permanently. If you own private property, you can accumulate stuff. That's called being blessed. And then you can be moved upon in your heart to give some of it away. That's called charity. When you look at what the government does, Karl Marx said, so communism can be summed up in one sentence: abolition of private property. And so if you don't own any property, how can you give any of it away? What are you going to do, steal from somebody else and then give it away? Now you're a thief? No. And so they've lied. They said, well, the early church, they owned everything in common. Two differences: voluntary versus involuntary. They voluntarily sold their land. They weren't forced to. And the second is church versus government. They laid the money at the feet of the apostles.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't bring the money to the feet of Pilate. Say, here, Pilate, here's a little more money for the government to spread around, and your politicians will spread it to those that can help them stay in power. Like in Egypt, we'll give you a bag of grain, but it's an exchange for your land, your cattle, your children, your lives. Whenever the government gives anything, it's in exchange for something. Whenever the church helps people, the only exchange is they want to help that person to become, feel the love of God, and then themselves become successful so they can help the next needy person that comes along.
So what happened to the church and its role in these areas then?
Right. So it was creeping in. First, it was, well, we'll help out. The church has a benevolence ministry to help the poor. And then the church is like, well, let's just pool together and have a feeding building, and a bunch of churches will pitch in for it. Okay, that's nice. And then the government comes along and says, we'll help, give a little money. And then the government says, well, we'll we want you to remove that cross because it's sort of, you know, it's intimidating to people. And then we want you to stop witnessing to them and stop proselyting and just be a distribution center for the government. And then the gospel's lost.
Great. Wow. Bill, we're going to have to jump ahead. Take us up to 1942 during World War II under FDR.
Right. So we had Woodrow Wilson, and he had the World War I income tax. It was reduced after the war to, again, only the extreme wealthy paying. But then World War II comes along, and FDR pushes through the largest tax increase in American history. He made it so that everybody pays taxes. And they had billboards up that said, smash the Axis, pay your taxes. The Axis were the Nazis and the Mussolini's Italians and the Japanese, Imperial Japan. And but it was this idea that, hey, you're doing your part if you pay it. The interesting thing was the bill came at the end of the year, and nobody had saved up money to pay the government this extra. And so Ernst Rummel, who was the chairman of Macy's department store, he became the head of the Federal Reserve, he came up with the idea of withholding, that you would have it withheld from your paycheck a little every month, and so you wouldn't realize at the end of the year that you just paid a big chunk of your salary to the federal government. And anyway, but this was all instituted as an emergency effort to get money to fight Hitler. Once the war stopped, it didn't, right? 3 years ago, there was a telephone tax, and it was originally put in place to raise money to pay for the Spanish-American War. And, I mean, here we are in the 1940s and 50s, and they're like, why are we paying this tax? You know, it's like, once they get in, they stay in. So John F. Kennedy, he said this in 1961, in meeting the demands of war finance, the individual income tax moved from a selective tax imposed on the wealthy to the means by which the great majority of our citizens participate in paying. So again, John F. Kennedy says it was for the purpose of the demands of war finance. And then Kennedy explains again, he goes, withholding on wages and salaries was introduced during the war when the income tax was extended to millions of new taxpayers. Again, emergency effort, World War II, instituted paycheck withholding. The war stopped, it didn't.
Bill Federer is with us here today on Crosstalk. And folks, we're going to take a quick break and come back, and we're going to hear a little bit more, because what I'm hearing from some of the principles President Kennedy had, he would not be welcomed by the party that he represented at that point. Today's party would not allow him to be in with his viewpoint. So we're going to pick up with this right after the break, but perhaps this is all new information for you about the history of the income tax and how we got to where we are. Bill has put this in a book called The Interesting History of Income Tax. It's about 176 pages. It's got pictures in it. It's available. Here our way of saying thank you for your support of $18 or more to Crosstalk. It's available online at vcyamerica.org, vcyamerica.org, or by calling 1-800-729-9829. We'll be back in 1 minute. This is Crosstalk on the VCY America Network.
Entertainment has become the draw to build churches and youth groups. Meanwhile, sound biblical teaching has fallen off the cliff. To many, it's all about numbers and little about the Bible. Play the Flute, a powerful DVD, addresses this issue head on. Play the Flute tells the story of one youth leader who would not give up, who would not surrender to the apathy taking over his new youth group.
The Lord Jesus is looking for followers who realize that they are sinners and need a Savior. These are his terms, and I can't change them.
From Rich Cristiano comes Play the Flute, a powerful story on DVD available from VCY America for a donation of $18 or more. And for a limited time, additional copies sent to the same address are available for a donation of just $15 more. Call 1-800-729-9829. 1-800-729-9829.
This is Crosstalk on VCY America. William J. Federer is our guest today. The history of the income tax. How did we get to this point? We're up to the point of President John F. Kennedy, and Bill, as I said, going into this break, he would not be a welcome. His views would not be welcomed by today's Democratic Party because he had some beliefs that sound more like they're coming from the Republican Party today than from the Democratic Party. But what did Kennedy believe on this issue of taxes and want to put into practice?
Right. So Kennedy saw that World War II is over. And we had a Marshall Plan where we were helping to rebuild Germany and Japan with brand new equipment. And they were producing stuff more efficiently and cheaper than we were. And they were beginning to take a percentage of the global market away from us. And we were still using pre-World War II old clunky machines. And so Kennedy said, we've got to do something to stimulate the businesses. And so he also saw that when you squeeze the sponge, the water goes out. And in other words, you make taxes higher over in America and the taxes are less in China, Japan, or Germany, or some other place, India, businesses will move. It's no different than if you are driving down the street and you need to buy some gas. And the gas station on this side of the street is $5 a gallon. And the gas station on the other side of the street is $2 a gallon. What are you going to do? You're going to make a left turn and go into the... And that's no different than a business saying, if I stay in America, I've got to pay more. But if I move my business overseas, I pay less. And so Kennedy was noticing this trend. And so he also noticed that the higher wages and benefits that were being paid in America push businesses out, more lawsuits in America, more government bureaucracy, more environmental restrictions, and then what's called favoritism or cronyism, where companies that donate to the politicians that are in power get favorable treatment, and if you don't donate it, then the government will crush your little business. And so so Kennedy was seeing these businesses leave, and the businesses, their choice was go out of business or go out of the country. And so we had 50 years of this, more and more businesses moving out. President Trump tried to reverse that. But Kennedy said this, I have asked the Secretary of Treasury to report whether present tax laws may be stimulating an undue amount of flow of American capital to industrial companies abroad. It's like, duh, right? Is higher taxes here, lower taxes there? Kennedy also says, in those countries where income taxes are lower than in the United States, the ability to defer the payment of U.S. tax by retaining income in subsidiary companies provides a tax advantage for companies operating through overseas subsidiaries, which is not available to companies operating solely in the United States. So these companies would move overseas, and then they would make their products and then ship them back into America. But then what about those tariff taxes? Well, they would use their money to buy politicians, and they would get the politicians to lower the tariff taxes so that they could bring stuff back into America cheaper. Years ago, I ran for Congress, and I went to this one factory where they made leather binders that they sold to Walmart and these big stores. And, you know, the guy supported my campaign. A couple years later, I ran for Congress. I go to the guy, his factory is empty, and he only has a couple people. And he says, Walmart came to him and says, we can get this exact binder made overseas, you know, probably through slave labor or something, but we can get it. She said they could get the finished product cheaper than what I could buy the raw material for. Wow. So I had a choice. I could go out of business, or guess what? I moved all my factory overseas, and we just got a couple of ladies in the office here to shuffle papers. So this is a real thing through taxes that can create or kill jobs in America. So Kennedy proposed tax cuts, and he says it was a stimulus plan. He goes, this is 1963. A tax cut means higher family income, higher business profits. Every taxpayer in his family will have more money left over after taxes for a new car, new home, new convenience, education, investment. Every businessman can keep a higher percentage of his profits and use that money to expand or improve his business. And as the federal government, will end up with more money. So in other words, if you have a growing economy, the federal government can take a smaller percentage and will still get money. So would you want to bigger percentage of zero or a smaller percentage of a big number. And so the idea was, let's give our businesses tax cuts so they can have brand new equipment and compete with those businesses that have moved overseas. And let's give people tax cuts so they can have more money to spend. What are they going to do? They're going to buy product, and in the factory will have to hire more workers to meet the increased demand, and so we'll get rid of unemployment. So the caveat is you give tax cuts to businesses that are in America, not to another business overseas, because that's not going to help anything.
Novel idea, lowering tax rates to stimulate economic activity, the soundest way to raise revenue, cut the rates.
Now, this was being challenged by a guy named John Maynard Keynes. He was a London economist, and he came up with something called debt-stimulated economy. What's that? Well, imagine a chalkboard, and a guy draws a bunch of arrows in a circle. So the top arrow is the government goes in debt by spending money in the private sector to help businesses create jobs. Those jobs will pay taxes. Those taxes will pay off the debt. It looks great on a chalkboard. The only problem is politicians said, hey, let's go a little more in debt and let the and then let the next Congress worry about paying it off. And the next Congress goes a little more in debt. So pretty soon you got congressmen that say, forget even worrying about paying the debt. We're just going to continue to go in debt, spend money, and then not worry about paying off the debt. And so this is where we've gotten into a trap. Mm-hmm. And there was an economist named James Buchanan. He won the Nobel Prize in economy in 1986. And he discovered, so he's an economist. He goes, why are these politicians voting for debt? We're paying so much of our federal taxes just on the debt service of this debt. It's not even paying off the debt. It's just, and there's no way we're going to pay this off. Why would politicians do this? He noticed that if the politician was up for re-election, they would vote to increase the debt so they could funnel money to their district because it'll help them get votes.
Yep.
And they won't vote for a tax increase to pay off the debt. And so he wins the Nobel Prize because he figures out what motivates politicians.
Wow.
Getting reelected.
Amazing, amazing. And they found that this going into debt, getting more money, paying off, so to speak, and all these pet projects, that's something that actually then benefited the politician.
Yeah, that they want to keep their job, mm-hmm. and they want voters to vote for them, and if they can tell their district, hey, I paid for a new highway, and I paid for a levee, or I paid for a bridge, then the people will like him and name the bridge after him, and he gets to keep his job. So it turns out where all these politicians do is they go up to the feeding trough, you know, like on a farm where you got the pigs, and they come to the feeding trough, and they want to bring home money to their district, and it ends up the federal government gets more in debt, more in debt, more in debt, and it just becomes this blob where all of your taxes are going just to pay the interest. And we turned a corner just a few years ago where it's now virtually impossible to pay off the debt. And so with that, the thought is, well, we'll just create more money. Okay, you create more money, what happens? More, if you're not increasing the number of goods and you increase the amount of money in the money supply, you will have more dollars chasing the same amount of goods, the price of the goods will go up. So there's no more real estate in America. What's there is there. And so if you have these stimulus bills with trillions of more dollars created, the price of real estate has got to go up.
Mm-hmm.
The things made in factory, everything's going to go up in price, and we're going to see inflation. Now, what is inflation? It causes all savings to evaporate. So you save up $1,000, and it can buy a certain amount of goods. But with inflation, that $1,000 ends up buying less and less and less until pretty soon it's the same as $10. Like Zimbabwe, they would print these $1 trillion notes, you know, these $1 trillion bills, but they couldn't buy anything with it.
Yep.
The price just continues to go up. And so the debt-stimulated economy sounds good on a chalkboard, but it always falls. And one of the things I bring out is that every major empire in world history, enormous debt is what finally caused it to collapse.
My.
And you look at the Roman Empire. As long as it was expanding and conquering, it would live off the wealth that it took from the people that it conquered. And so the people in the city of Rome, where they were living high on the hog because they're keeping this more money coming in. But when they finally maxed out and Hadrian built his great wall, they weren't expanding anymore. So now they had to live within their means, and they were used to spending, and they get in debt, and the Roman Empire finally craters. The Mongolian Empire, Genghis Khan, right? He conquers from Korea to Hungary to Russia as the largest contiguous land empire in world history, and they invented paper currency. And Kublai Khan, like, printed too much of it until pretty soon nobody wanted it, and they got in debt, and the great Mongolian Empire then craters. Florence had the Italian Medici family, but they got in debt. And then Philip of Spain, he had his Spanish Armada attack England, and it sank, and he lost a lot of money. And then he had another Spanish Armada attack England, and it was destroyed in a hurricane, and two of them. And then you had another emperor, Philip III. He tried to send an armada to conquer England, and it gets smashed, and Spain was bankrupted. And so they were getting lots of gold from the New World, but they were spending it as fast as they got it. They weren't putting it into helping Spanish businesses become successful. You had the Holy Roman Empire. You had the French Empire, which for a while was the largest empire in the world. It fell because of debt. The Confederacy in America South, it got in debt and cratered. The Ottoman Empire. So here you had 1087, the Muslims invade the Byzantine Empire. They destroy all seven churches that were in the book of Revelation. They finally conquer Constantinople. And the Muslims lived and taxed the non-Muslims. And so if you were a Christian, you would have to ransom your life once a year by paying an enormous tax. Well, over the centuries, either the Christians would convert to Islam, or they would die off, or they would leave, and the tax base left. And the Ottoman Empire got in debt and then eventually cratered. Tsar Nicholas of Russia, it was his empire got in debt. Finally, Britain, they had World War I, World War II. They got in debt and cratered. And then the Soviet Union. Reagan put in place an arms race where we spent money to have the top-notch military equipment and missiles, and Russia wanted to keep up, but they kept spending more and more on military and less on building their economy and their businesses and so forth, that you couldn't even buy a loaf of bread at their grocery store. And so it caused Russia to bankrupt. So financial bankruptcy always precedes the end of a civilization or an empire. And in America, we are voluntarily doing to ourselves what we did to the Soviet Union. We caused them to spend money they didn't have. They went bankrupt. We're voluntarily bankrupting ourselves.
We're taking a quick break here, folks. We're opening our phone lines as well. If you'd like to ask Bill a quick question, a brief comment, 800-733-9829. That's 1-800-733-9829. The history of the income tax. And folks, where we're headed is for internal destruction, economically speaking, and as a nation. Back in a minute.
For the Worldview Report, I'm Brandon House. In February of 2021, the United States Navy put out a report entitled Extremism Stand Down. I had the report within 9 days of it being released because a friend of mine in military intelligence sent me the PDF. This document, which I'm sure has been made for other branches of the military, is all about the fact that the military will not be making promotions until they clean out the military from all of the extremists. As you read the document, you find out that by extremist, they mean, among other things, people that possess and live out the values of a Judeo-Christian worldview. People must not only accept, but embrace and even celebrate the LGBTQ agenda. The terms in this document are, well, open to interpretation. You can't attend a rally, financially support, post information online from anyone that's called an extremist. Would that be you? Would that be this radio network?
A Again, a reminder, Bill's book, The Interesting History of Income Tax, available through Crosstalk, our way of saying thank you for your support of $18 or more, available at vcyamerica.org, vcyamerica.org, or by calling 1-800-729-9829. We've got a number of callers lined up here, but Bill, just before we do, you had an interesting quote from former President Ford.
Right. So the socialist movement is the government's going to take care of everybody's health care and welfare and schooling and everything. And he gave a quote, 1974, Gerald Ford. He says, people propose that the government provide more benefits. He said, the government big enough to give us everything we want is a government big enough to take away everything we have.
Mm.
So basically, it's a backdoor into socialism by getting everybody to receive enough free stuff from the government, they get dependent on it, and they, okay.
Yep, yep. Let's go to Al, calling in from Milwaukee. You're on the air, Al.
There's a website called LostHorizons.com, and the gentleman there wrote a book called Cracking the Code, and the majority of Americans are not even subject to the income tax. So it's very interesting, the website and that book.
Okay. Thank you, Al. Don't know if you're familiar with it, Bill. Let's go to Doug in Kansas. You're on the air, Doug.
Hi, how you all doing today? And thank you for having me on.
Mm-hmm.
I would like to, I know you're going to get a lot of people calling up not wanting to pay income taxes now, but I do kind of want to clarify something and ask this gentleman. I'm actually one of them guys that quit paying at one time, but I found out, and I was in constant, you know, with communication with the IRS during the time.
Mm-hmm.
But I found out during my study that on the bottom of the W-4, it talks about, do you anticipate a tax liability? Well, I had later found out that from a court ruling that a man has a right to get up in the morning, make a living without being taxed. The way they get away with it is what, and I want to ask this if you would agree with me, is the way they get away with it, the definition of income tax is money derived off of profit and gain. When a gentleman wakes up in the morning and goes to work and he switches his labor for money, it's called compensation. Big
okay.
difference.
Okay, well, I'll have him comment on that. Bill?
Yeah, well, it's interesting that Lenin said that you grind the middle class out of existence between the two millstones of taxation and inflation. So in other words, for every socialist experiment, you have to get rid of the middle class. And so Lenin killed off the kulaks, the K-U-L-A-K-S. They were the farmers. They were the middle class. And all that was left was the rich people and the mass of poor everybody else. Well, once he killed off all the kulak farmers, they had a famine in 1921-22, and a million people died. And it's like, gee, you know, didn't see that coming. But the goal of it, in Lenin's mind, is that you grind this middle class out of existence between the two millstones of taxation and inflation. So there's, you know, some people say, well, why don't they just create more money rather than tax people for it, you know, because they're creating trillions of dollars out of nothing right now.
Hmm. Interesting. And I guess the aspect of you mentioned there is some controversy about the passing of this amendment, whether Americans are subject to the income tax or not. Is that question still hanging out there, Bill?
Well, it is one. You know, I tell people, what hill do you want to die on?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I know somebody that, you know, they hadn't paid the income tax in 30 years and you know, they're not able to get a job, and they got a college degree,
yeah.
But and it's like, you know, his whole life is like limited because of this. You know, I want to die on the hill of standing up for Jesus.
Amen.
and allowing the freedom of the mm-hmm. gospel to be proclaimed. And you know, if you've
yeah, I got you. Thank you.
What issue is the most important to you? And to me, mm-hmm. I focus my energy on, you know, pay your taxes.
Thank you, Doug. Jesus, thank you for the call.
It's old, you know, rendered Caesar what Caesar and God what God.
Yeah, and that's how Jesus responded when he was asked about paying tribute, to render to Caesar that which is Caesar's, to God that which is God's. We have Randy calling next. Randy, you're on the air.
Okay. Yes, this is Randy, and I appreciate your program. And my question for your guest is, how will the creation of digital currency continue the Ponzi scheme we got going now of the creation of money. And I'll hang up so I can hear. Thank you.
How can digital currency...
We're seeing that the mass printing, of course, they don't print anymore. It's all just creating money through an entry. But the mass creating of dollars is going to cause the value of dollars to go down, which is going to cause other countries around the world to not want to have dollars because their savings in dollars is going to evaporate. So they're going to be motivated to go either into, a gold-based thing or digital currencies. And so China is now creating their version of a digital currency and mandating it in a bunch of different cities in China. And once they get it perfected, they're going to try to take it worldwide and Europe. And then there's a Fed coin where and then whoever is in the business of controlling that will be the one to benefit off it. Hmm. And the country that is the world's currency is called the reserve currency. Is in a unique position. If Korea or some country can't pay their bills, they just can't create more of their currency. But America can because the whole world has been using the dollar. Hmm. But with us being irresponsible, fewer and fewer countries are going to want to take the dollar. And so there's going to be lots of dollars, and so there will be inflation. Hmm. And so there will be a movement, what a lot of people think, toward digital coins. And then, at some point it'll be one that it'll be, they think will be trackable. And they'll know what you buy and what you sell and maybe control it. So it's a direction that is probably going to be more of a Book of Revelation type of thing.
Yeah, indeed. Thank you, Randy. And, with less than 30 seconds left in the program, we're not able to grab any more phone calls. Bill Fitter, our guest here today, and so much more information in his book called The Interesting History of Income Tax. It's available, our way of saying thank you for your support of $18 or more, available at vcyamerica.org or by calling 800-729-9829. Bill, thank you for such interesting information and putting so much into perspective, but it really comes as a warning to us as well.
Well, Reagan said, I believe God did intend for mankind to invent, produce, and create, and for that reason it would be wrong for governments to devise tax structure to suppress those gifts. Hmm. So let's be creative and trust the Lord, but the book is a real eye-opener that will help people to understand.
Bill, thank you for being with us today.
Thank you.
And folks, thank you for joining us here today on Crosstalk.
You've been listening to Crosstalk via satellite and the internet from VCY America. Views expressed may or may not be those of this station. For a CD of today's program, send a donation of $6 or more to VCY Tape Ministry, 3434 West Kilbourne Avenue, Milwaukee, Wisconsin, 53208. Or download by RSS or podcast from crosstalkamerica.com. And join us again for Crosstalk.